Well, the long-stalled federal farm bill is finally moving through Congress. House and Senate leaders are announcing a compromise plan that puts an end to decades of direct payment farm subsidies. It also imposes a 1% cut on food stamps. The bill cuts more than $30 billion from the farm program altogether. It's 2 years overdue. The last farm bill was approved in 2008. It was given a one-year extension that expired last September, and the House could vote on the plan this week. We'll be sure to ask Congressman Mike Rogers about this tomorrow morning when he and I talk about the President's State of the Union address. So we'll add that to our list of questions. And, of course, Debbie Stabenow of Lansing chairs the Senate Agriculture Committee. Glad you're back here at Current State. Later this hour, I'm always interested when a rails-to-trails network expands. Such an interesting repurposing of something old into something new. And we've got a plan in our backyard taking shape. It would expand rails-to-trails specifically from Owosso to Ionia. We will talk with the leader of that effort coming up a little bit later on. To start off our show, a coalition of labor and civil rights groups calling itself Raise Michigan has announced its intention to form a ballot campaign committee. It's a procedural step that could lead to a statewide vote this November on raising the minimum wage, which in Michigan is currently $7.40 an hour. Frank Houston's the director of the Restaurant Opportunities Center of Michigan, which is part of the coalition, and he joins us by phone to tell us more. Welcome to Current State, Frank.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
You've formed a ballot proposal committee. Next is putting the actual proposal together. You've come this far. What do you and your coalition partners have left to work out?
Well, I think we're taking, you know, a few more days just to review potential policy that we'd want to put in for a ballot initiative. And, you know, who knows, maybe the governor and the state legislature has a change of heart in the next couple days and do what they should have already done, which is raise minimum wage. But we expect to make a decision in a matter of days, maybe a week. And I think it's highly likely that we'll be moving forward with putting in language with the Board of Canvassers and moving forward on collecting a whole lot of signatures.
Now, Democratic gubernatorial candidate Mark Schauer has proposed getting up to $9.25 an hour. Would that be acceptable to the members of your group?
Well, I think it's in the ballpark. I mean, you know, what we've been saying all along is that there's several good proposals out there. I think there's many in our coalition that would prefer it be closer to the president's proposal at $10.10 an hour. But I think what Congressman Schauer proposed is at least in the right direction and will be similar to, I think, whatever we finalize. Representative Rashida Tlaib also has a bill in that our coalition has openly supported, which does a $10 an hour increase. And also make sure that tipped employees are getting a raise and that if the minimum wage would be indexed to inflation. So it keeps going up each year so folks don't fall deeper into poverty just by working the same job 2 years in a row.
Now, the federal minimum wage was just raised in 2009 to $7.25 an hour, which is lower than Michigan's current rate of $7.40 an hour. Why do we need to raise it again here in Michigan?
I think it's pretty simple, actually. I mean, despite the minimum wage going up slightly the last few years, the reality is that, you know, a lot of people working full-time for minimum wage are living in poverty. You know, over half the people who work for minimum wage are actually, you know, trying to support a family and adults. These aren't, you know, high school kids, you know, trying to just get job training and save up a little money for college. So when you look at the fact that, you know, if you're a family of three, and there's one full-time minimum wage worker as you're the primary breadwinner of the family, that family is living in poverty right now. So the idea is by raising the minimum wage, even slightly, you know, a couple bucks here we're talking about, this isn't, you know, huge money, that does have a huge impact on families that are struggling to stay above the poverty line. And we believe that, you know, really fair work and, you know, deserves fair pay. And, you know, I think the sooner we get an increase, we can have a real meaningful bottom-up impact that can help stimulate the economy and help a lot of working people.
It's worth mentioning, you mentioned it a second ago here, that hourly wages for tipped employees is even less. Explain to our listeners how that works.
Well, what Michigan has is comparable to the federal standard, which is a tipped credit system, which means that workers that do tip jobs, we know, are expected to make, you know, above minimum wage when you factor in tips. Unfortunately, I think the enforcement of that is very lax, and even more unfortunate is the actual wage level. So federally, the tipped employee level, so what a tipped employee is guaranteed to make as their hourly rate, is only $2.13 an hour. And in Michigan, we have a whopping $2.65 pay for tipped employees. So if you're a waiter or a waitress, you're making $2.65 an hour. And although, yes, there's often days where they do better than that and they bring home enough tipped wages to go far above minimum wage, there's also days where they have a slow day and they're making $2.65 an hour and sent home early, not even making enough money to put gas in the car. So the idea here is that we at least believe that all workers should be guaranteed making at least minimum wage every time they go into work. You know, I mean, no one should have to live, you know, day to day wondering if they're even going to make, you know, $7.40 an hour, let alone higher. So we really believe it's time that we eliminate some of these loopholes in the minimum wage laws and make sure everybody is making at least minimum wage.
So ultimately, Frank, where would all of these raises come from?
I'm not quite sure I understand the question. I mean, like, how is it paid for? Or?
Yes. Where does the money come from to bump up the minimum wage?
Well, I think there's usually a couple. I mean, if you look at every time minimum wage goes up, just like when we passed it here in 2006 and agreed to phase in a minimum wage increase to $7.40 an hour, it's a combination of sources. You know, one is some of the costs of raising minimum wage, small business owners will pass along to consumers. You know, so maybe you pay 25 cents more for a meal at a diner. The reality, though, is that when you look at all the states that have raised minimum wage on their own, there's really no inflation that's shown from that. It's so negligible. The second is that I think, particularly for larger businesses, ones that do, you know, you're talking $10 million to $20 million or more a year in gross receipts, they'll absorb a small part of those costs. And then the reality also is that in many, many states, it's shown that when you raise minimum wage, because folks who make a little more tend to spend a little more, particularly if you're a low-wage worker, you're not, you know, jetting off out of the country on a vacation, you're spending that money back in your community. So a lot of those extra earnings actually just get recycled back in the local economy. And it's also probably worth noting that small businesses in Michigan, just like nationwide, are actually exempt from some of the minimum wage provisions to begin with. You know, if you're a real small mom-and-pop place and you do under $500,000 a year in business, you don't have to pay minimum wage now. And I don't think at this point we're talking about changing that in the law.
What about small businesses, Frank, that are on the bubble already, for whom an increase in their expenditures would arguably put them out of business?
Like I said, the smallest businesses generally actually are already exempt from minimum wage law because they're so small. So, I mean, the idea of that is, you know, if you're a small restaurant with 5 to 10 employees and you're only doing $450,000 to $500,000 a year in transactions, you don't have to pay minimum wage already. But I think there's a question about, you know, business models that rely on workers living in poverty and if that's ethical to begin with. So I'm not trying to be cold and heartless, but I think any small business owner that can't pay someone $9 to $10 an hour probably has a broken model to begin with. And I think the idea here is that, you know, we want to be building businesses in Michigan, good jobs, not just low-wage jobs. But if it's going to be a low-wage job, it can't be, you know, we wouldn't want it based off child labor practices, and we don't want it based off of people living in poverty. So once again, the smallest businesses are actually exempt. And then the ones that are, you know, a little bit above that, I think there is a question about, well, that's okay if they're on the bubble, but this is actually a way that they can have more money being spent locally at their institutions from workers. And also, I think, providing a more ethical model for how employees are compensated.
We're talking with Frank Houston, director of the Restaurant Opportunities Center of Michigan, part of a coalition that aims to get a ballot campaign, a ballot proposal on the ballot this fall to raise Michigan's minimum wage. What about entry-level work experience, Frank? If wages are raised for the lowest-level workers, won't companies be less motivated to invest money to train them?
I actually think it's quite the opposite. And there's a few things that I would reframe about how you think about training wages and entry into the workforce. generally speaking, if you pay people a little more, they're more likely to stay at a job. So a lot of businesses, being in the restaurant industry or elsewhere, are going to retain good employees if they get that little bump up. I mean, with tipped employees, you're talking they haven't even had a nominal raise really in the last 22 years. So that little bit of an increase actually can retain employees. But aside from that, Michigan actually does have a training wage where, you know, for the first couple of months on a job, people can get, well, are actually right now paid less than minimum wage already. In addition to that, we also have different loopholes where folks who are, for instance, high school students are not required by law to be paid minimum wage. So I think there's a lot of things that Michigan legislators have structured into the law over the years to make it easier and cheaper for businesses to have these entry points for people, particularly younger people, into the workforce. But over the time, they've become these loopholes where, you know, and with things like the tip credit, where folks who've been there now 10, 20 years at a job don't get a raise. So I think that the goal here is to level that out when you talk about increasing things like not just minimum wage, but the wage for tipped employees.
Let's revisit that, because that is so interesting. I mean, at the risk of getting in the weeds here, how is that $2.13 an hour, $2.65 an hour, how is that arrived at?
You know, I can't tell you the origin of it, but I think the political reality of it is that, you know, back, you know, this is 22 years ago, when minimum wage went up, you know, it was a Republican president, a Democratic Congress, a lot of pressure on both sides of the political aisle to raise minimum wage, and a lot of pressure put on both sides of the partisan politics to not hurt the restaurant industry in particular. And instead of really trying to figure out a fair minimum wage level for everyone, they just said, you know what, we're just going to punt on tipped employees. And it doesn't affect just tipped employees from restaurants. It also affects folks like agricultural workers and others. So instead of actually really hashing out that debate, we punted as a nation and said, we're not going to raise wages for tipped employees and farm workers and so on. And that just continues to be the de facto way that Democrats and Republicans have resolved any disputes over when to raise minimum wage and how much and how to do it. They just always leave tipped workers behind. And that's what's so tragic, you know, for instance, and I've worked on minimum wage, you know, campaigns like this before, and every single time the first thing that goes off the table is giving tipped workers a raise. So that, I can't talk about the logic initially behind it other than that they assumed that tipped employees would be making $9-$10 an hour right now without an increase, but the bottom line is it just doesn't work out for a lot of people in this state.
I guess the thing that intrigues me, Frank, is that somebody somewhere assigns a value to gratuities, and that is that becomes a part of this equation. I'm just curious who that is and how that unfolds.
Yeah, no, I can't tell you, you know, decades ago where that came from, but I mean, like, who came up with the original idea off the top of my head. But what I can say is, for instance, if you look at our membership at Rock Michigan, we have, you know, waiters and waitresses that make close to six figures. And then we also have, and, you know, bartenders and so on, and then we also have some that don't even come close to making minimum wage every day. And the idea, I think, here is that everyone, every single worker should go into work each day and know that for every hour they're working, they're getting at least the minimum wage. It is supposed to be the minimum. That's the name, right? So, I think that's the goal here.
Last year, during the fast food strikes, in that time frame, we did hear about some restaurant owners who are supportive of higher wages for their workers. Are they the exception, or are there more of them than the public might think?
I think there's more of them than people realize. I mean, it's funny when you talk to restaurant owners, which we, aside from doing advocacy with waiters and waitresses and bartenders and other restaurant workers, we also actually partner with businesses on a lot of workforce development for restaurant workers, providing training and support and trying to play matchmaker between potential restaurant workers and employers. So we work a lot with restaurants. And what we find is, more often than not, a lot of them are paying already well over minimum wage and are actually almost insulted by the fact when you say, oh, we need to raise minimum wage. And they're like, we're already paying $10 an hour. And, you know, so I think a lot of actually employers are already doing that. We actually formed something called a High Road Coalition, which is a group of employers that do pay well over, you know, minimum wage. And when you look at some of the restaurants that are getting in the news around this, I mean, some are paying $15 an hour and still have found a way to make a buck off of this, make far more than a buck. So there are business models out there where I think if a restaurant has a good product and running well, and people know that they're also responsible socially to their employees, I think there's a market there for that without question.
And Frank, one last question. When exactly do you expect to have a finished proposal?
I don't want to bind everyone in our coalition to an abstract date, but I think you're looking at within a week to 2 weeks at most here. And like I said, we are doing one last check to make sure we're ready to move forward with an initiative, because the idea here is not just to launch a petition drive, but to get something on the ballot that we will also win. This isn't an academic or a political exercise for us. This is about having real impact on so many workers that are struggling right now, that go to work every day, work hard, and need a raise. So I would say within 2 weeks at the latest.
Frank Houston is the director of the Restaurant Opportunity Center of Michigan, which is part of the Raise Michigan Coalition, a group that may seek a statewide vote this November to raise the minimum wage. Thanks for joining us, Frank.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. At the end of each month, we check in with Great Lakes commentator and journalist Gary Wilson for updates on environmental stories from around the basin. For today's Great Lakes Month in Review, we're focusing on ice cover, a timely topic, and Asian carp. A few weeks ago, I spoke with Gary after the Army Corps study on Asian carp in the Great Lakes was released, and Gary rejoins us now. Welcome back.
Hey, good morning, Mark. And as I was listening to your weather report a few minutes ago, I think you guys actually have it a little bit colder in Lansing than we do here in Chicago.
Well, there are so many weather anomalies, I can scarcely get over it. If memory serves, it hit 51 degrees yesterday in Nome, Alaska.
Wow.
So
okay.
Think about that. I also read this morning that for many parts of Michigan, it is the coldest January since 1977. So.
Yeah, well, I think we're going to talk about ice a little bit later, so it's as you said, it's appropriate.
That's right. Let's talk about ice, since we're already talking about ice.
There's
been a lot of activity since the Army Corps study, though. Let's open up with Asian carp here. Bring us up to date on what's happening since that Army Corps study was released.
Sure, Mark. You're right. We talked about this when the landmark Army Corps study was released a couple of weeks ago. That's just a quick summary. Calling for, advising the region that if they want physical separation of the Great Lakes from the Mississippi to keep Asian carp and other aquatic invasives out, it was going to cost about $18 billion and take 20 to 25 years. Since then, the Corps has been traveling the region and holding public comment sessions. Started in Chicago, went up to Milwaukee, over to Cleveland. It was in Michigan last week, and it's been interesting to see what's going on there. I attended the public comment session in Chicago. I've talked to people who were at the Cleveland session, and it's quite interesting. These sessions have been what I would say is moderately attended in Milwaukee. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel said it was lightly attended, and one source in Cleveland said that he really thought, and this is somebody who studies this thing over time, that the attendance in Cleveland was, quote, pathetic, given that Lake Erie is the one great lake that would be most impacted by if Asian carp got into the lake. So
is there any pattern to the comments that are being brought up at these?
There is, and they're very predictable, Mark. The first hearings on Asian carp were probably in the winter of 2010. That was a few months after the environmental DNA was discovered past the electrical barriers in the Chicago waterway system. And I attended a number of those, and comments were very predictable. Environmentalists, some very passionate, concerned citizens who aren't necessarily affiliated with any organization, they were adamant and vociferous about something needing to be done. On the other side of the coin, business interests, usually led by the Chamber of Commerce and shipping interests that would be impacted if there was physical separation or if locks were closed, they were also adamant that they didn't want to see that would happen. That would cause severe economic damage to themselves, and they say the region. 4 years later, as I watch these hearings unfold, it's kind of the same people talking about the same things. The dial hasn't moved one way or the other, so that's a little bit disappointing.
Well, it jumps back at me as well. You said that the critics of the Cleveland gathering maintained that it was turnout was pathetic or tragically low. Are invasive species relegated to the back burner in terms of people's awareness, even here in the Great Lakes?
I think that what some people in the region, and I'm one of them, say is that carp fatigue has set in. These Asian carp stories have been in the news fairly regularly, like I said, for 4 years. When people are constantly seeing an issue that and the dial doesn't seem to move one way or the other, I think there's a tendency to tune out. Granted, environmental groups are still very actively engaged. The business and shipping interests are actively engaged because they feel threatened by any movement towards physical separation. But I think the general public has had this tendency to go, okay, I've heard this story before.
Mm-hmm.
I and others call that carp fatigue.
Well, let's change topics here back to this low ice cover on the Great Lakes. Our fascination with ice has been revived this winter, as we mentioned, with the long cold spells around the region. What's going on?
Well, ice cover in the past few years has been diminishing with the warm winters. It dropped to as low as about 30% the last couple of years, according to the Great Lakes Environmental Research Lab. But this year, with the protracted cold weather, not just a short cold snap, it's up approaching 70%. And in Lake Erie, the smallest and shallowest of the lakes, it's almost 100%. So ice is back. You're right, we do have a fascination with it. People like to go out and look at the ice cover here in Chicago. I've been over in western Michigan and seen people going out to the lake and staring at the ice and lake and seeing ice for just as far as they could see. So we do have this fascination with it. But there's a scientific angle to this, too. Ice cover helps prevent evaporation. Evaporation affects lake levels, and low lake levels affect the economy, and especially in Michigan, which has such a big lake economy that affects tourism. So our fascination is scientific and economic.
I want to back up just a little bit. When you say ice cover is 70% this winter, is that 70% of what's considered normal?
No, 70% of the total surface of the Great Lakes.
Okay.
That was... It's been down as low as 30% in the last few years.
Oh, that is dramatic. Well, yes. a new study by U of M and MSU further explores the correlation between ice cover and evaporation. How does this study explain the relationship?
Well, it's complex. It's a little bit revelatory. In simple terms, cold weather, cold winters leads to the ice cover, which prevents evaporation. But the study has found out that what happens in the fall is also important. We think of January, but October with the cold weather winters lead to colder water temperatures. But those colder water temperatures can also facilitate evaporation when the lake temperature is cold and the air temperature is higher, and especially in the fall, that can lead to evaporation. So it's a complex issue. I've read a couple of articles about this study, and it's a little bit counterintuitive. It's hard to get your arms around it.
Mm.
So both the institutions have said they need to do more and want to do more to help us understand this.
We're talking with current state contributor Gary Wilson, who's a Great Lakes commentator and environmental journalist. The Great Lakes Restoration Initiative got $300 million in the 2014 appropriations bill. Any information on how that money might be broken down?
Yes, Mark, that's good news for the region. Throughout this whole, all these budget battles, the region has generally been able to maintain that funding for the Great Lakes at somewhere between $280 and $300 million. The EPA has priorities to use this money. Cleaning up the toxic hotspots is probably the biggest use of it. And White Lake in western Michigan is expected to be taken off the list of toxic hotspots, you know, as early as the spring, and that'll be a big accomplishment. But fighting algae is another priority, and then it goes on down to restoring wetlands and a number of less visible topics. But cleaning up these toxic hotspots that have been lingering for 30 years will get a big piece of the money. I did talk to the EPA's Cameron Davis. He's the top advisor on Great Lakes issues to the White House. And back to Asian carp, he was telling me about $16 million of that money will go to fighting Asian carp. So that's a healthy chunk of money.
This month, Senators Stabenow and Levin expressed concern over a pipeline running through the Straits of Mackinac, an Enbridge pipeline. How did the Federal Pipeline Hazardous Material Safety Administration respond to the senators' complaints?
Well, they took them under advisement, and they did respond. They understood. They said they understood the concern, but they also said that they have been working with Enbridge. And to just remind our listeners, Enbridge is the company that owns the pipeline that was responsible for the Kalamazoo River spill a few years ago. But they told the senators that they have been working with Enbridge. Enbridge has made significant safety improvements, and this agency was involved before Enbridge was allowed to increase the volume of oil that moves through the pipeline that goes through the Straits of Mackinac. So no big revelations here. The government is saying, yes, we appreciate your concern. Yes, we agree that you should be concerned, and we're on top of it. So we'll have to see how that plays out. I don't see the environmental groups backing off on this.
And what do you expect to be covering in February, Gary? What are you keeping your eyes on?
Well, I'm going to watch the wrap-up of the Asian of the Army Corps' work. They've got a few more meetings. But I'm really waiting for somebody to step up in Washington to say we're going to take ownership and try to move it along. I've got a request into Senator Stabenow's office. She's really been on the point for this to see what her plans are, and I haven't received a response yet, but I'll be following up, and I hope to be able to share that with you in the future.
We look forward to that. Gary Wilson is a Great Lakes commentator and journalist. Gary, thank you for your time.
Always good to be with you, Mark. Thank you.
This segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and on Current State every Tuesday as part of our partnership. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Reach us via email at currentstate@wkar.org with story ideas and any feedback you may have. Last week, Michigan Governor Rick Snyder offered a proposal he thinks will jumpstart Detroit's struggling economy. At a company in predominantly Hispanic Southwest Detroit, the governor said he wants the federal government to increase the number of skilled immigrants allowed to move to Michigan to 50,000 over 5 years. That's on the condition that they live and work in Detroit. The governor points to data suggesting a multiplier effect involving skilled immigrants, that every one creates more than 2.5 additional jobs. The proposal needs to be vetted by federal immigration authorities. To explain, Current State welcomes Dr. Jonathan Weinberg. Jonathan's a law professor specializing in immigration law at Wayne State University. Welcome, John.
Hi, good to be here.
The governor needs the federal government's assistance with this. Explain what he would like them to do, please.
The federal government's got a program to give immigrant visas to immigrants who have advanced degrees in the professions or who have exceptional ability in the sciences, arts, and business. And there are some requirements you need to meet here. One of them is you need to have a job offer from a U.S. employer. Another one, for most of those folks, is that the U.S. employer has to show that there isn't a U.S. citizen in the area who's ready, willing, and able to do the work. The governor is asking the federal government to waive those last two requirements so long as the person promises to live and work in Detroit. So, under Governor Snyder's plan, if you're a foreign citizen, you want to come to the U.S., you have an advanced degree in the professions, whether or not you've got a job offer from a U.S. employer, whether or not there are U.S. citizens available to do the work, you can just come so long as you're willing to live and work in New York. Sorry, in Detroit.
Is the governor essentially hoping that there is enough support for giving Detroit a hand, that the immigration officials will approve this, will carve out this this exemption?
Well, that's his hope. This isn't the way immigration authorities usually work. I mean, the way Homeland Security typically approaches this, they would say, well, gee, if there is a need for skilled immigrants to come into American cities to jumpstart their economies in the way Governor Snyder's contemplating, we wouldn't do it just for Detroit. We'd do a nationwide study. We'd see what cities need this sort of help. We'd try to develop a list. We'd approach it systematically and take it from there. He's saying, forget all that. I just want a Detroit rule. And even if they're sympathetic to his goals, I think that's going to be a harder sell.
Hmm. Is there any kind of precedent for this, John?
Yeah, there is. The statute has a provision with pretty similar requirements for doctors who want to come to the U.S. and they're willing to live in medically underserved areas or who are going to work at VA hospitals or other VA facilities. That's a good example, though. In that case, Department of Homeland Security had Department of Health and Human Services make up a list of all of the medically underserved areas across the country, and you can get this waiver by going to work in any of them. It's not a matter of they're saying, gee, Louisville has told us we don't have enough doctors, so we're going to make a Louisville rule.
From your perspective, how seriously do you think the feds will consider this?
Well, I think the feds are going to take this seriously. Immigration is a major issue. The health of Detroit, I think, is an important matter. This isn't something they're simply going to ignore. But I'd be very surprised if they approve this in the form in which it's been presented.
Are you confident in the end they'll comply, or is it just too unpredictable?
Well, I mean, what I think they might do is they might initiate the process, and this is not what the governor wants, but they might initiate a process where they say, well, Governor Snyder's got a point, let's try and make a list of all of the cities nationwide where they might do this. And then, maybe a year or so from now, we might move to, that sort of waiver for a bunch of cities. That's not what the governor wants, because then Detroit doesn't have the exclusive franchise on an easy route for skilled immigrants to come to the U.S., but I think that's what he's more likely to get.
We're talking with Dr. Jonathan Weinberg. Jonathan's a law professor specializing in immigration law at Wayne State University. We're talking about Governor Snyder's proposal last week to try to get more skilled immigrants specifically to come to Detroit. The governor emphasized that this proposal is about job creation, not about training people for existing jobs that are unfilled, although he told NPR just after the address that training efforts are ongoing. What do you make of this multiplier effect? Is that backed up by the facts, in your view?
I think it is. I mean, when it's an oversimplification to say that bringing trained immigrants to Detroit is somehow magically going to solve the city's problems. But I think the governor's got a good point that if you bring in skilled, entrepreneurial, well-educated people who are driven to do something to help the economy, that's going to help, and that's going to help in ways that we couldn't really achieve through other means.
I wanted to get your response to a point made by Bridge Magazine's Phil Power, and you alluded earlier to the Department of Homeland Security, who will be looking at this proposal. Mr. Power feels it's bizarre, his word, that Homeland Security is in charge of the EB-5 program and not the Commerce Department. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, back in the day, there was a time when the government agency that was in charge of all of our immigration programs was the department that was then called the Department of Commerce and Labor. And the Department of Commerce and Labor decided who could come and who could go, and people thought that was a good system at the time. A while later on, with the Second World War and security concerns, we were distrustful of immigrants. We moved that to the Justice Department. And after 9/11 and the Patriot Act, we moved that to the Department of Homeland Security. So you can look at that and say there's been a shift throughout the years from viewing immigrants as a source of economic vitality to viewing immigrants as, people we need to be afraid of.
How important in general is immigration in helping Detroit out of its quandary?
Immigration is not the only answer, and immigration can't be the only answer to helping Detroit out of its quandary. Now, I think this would help. I think the governor is onto something real here. Now, this administration, this state's government, has not always been especially welcoming to immigrants in general. The state government has been charged, I think rightly, with being indeed unwelcoming to low-income, low-educated migrants, and has been one of the state governments that has been, in certain ways, most firmly devoted to not integrating unauthorized migrants. But when it comes to the best and the brightest, when it comes to, highly educated, usually fairly well-off folks, the governor is determined to put out the welcome mat.
We've been talking about the EB-5 program here, but in the alphabet soup that is the immigration program in this country, we hear regularly about H-1B visas as well. Do immigrants holding H-1B visas figure into this discussion?
Well, I actually want to take a step back. The skilled immigrant program is the EB-2 program. The governor also wants to do more with the EB-5 program, which is an investor program.
Okay.
And in the EB-5 program, basically, if you have $500,000 to invest in a business in Detroit, you can come in that way. That program was designed for entrepreneurs. In the last decade or so, with the advent of something called regional centers, that's been used more nearly for passive investments of $1 million in many places in the country, of $500,000 in high unemployment areas like Detroit.
Very interesting. I appreciate the clarification there.
And that's another route the governor definitely wants to go down. H-1B is another important way of getting highly skilled immigrants into the country. It's been somewhat controversial because people, especially in the U.S. tech industry, feel that H-1B visa holders are taking jobs away from Americans who are here, ready, willing, and able to do the work. That's always the size of this debate. For that reason, the Congress has put fairly severe caps on the size of the H-1B program. Employers would love to bring in more H-1B visa holders. They're not allowed because of the caps. That's an area that Governor Snyder is not addressing, and indeed, that could not be addressed unless Congress passed a new law.
Interesting discussion. We'll keep an eye on it. We want to thank our special guest, Dr. Jonathan Weinberg. John's a law professor specializing in immigration law at Wayne State University in Detroit. Thank you, John.
A pleasure to be here.
Its current state on WKAR, well, a long hike or a bike ride on a warm Michigan spring day may seem a long way off right now, but plans are in the works to build a new trail line in mid-Michigan north of Lansing. Bids could go out as soon as next month to build a 42-mile trail on the site of an abandoned rail line from Owosso to Ionia. The project is part of a much larger plan that would create a sweeping 125-mile trail that would loop through parts of five counties. Now, joining us today by phone is Lynn Mason. Lynn's the chair of the Midwest Rail Trail Authority, which is overseeing the project. She's also a four-term county commissioner in Ionia County. Lynn Mason, welcome to Current State.
Hello, thanks for having me.
This proposed trail from Owosso to Ionia, and it just dawned on me about 10 minutes ago, I grew up about 50 feet from the rail from the rail line that we're talking about here this morning, so I know exactly the trail that you're talking about. Interestingly enough,
that's pretty exciting, isn't it?
Goes through Ovid on the way from Owosso to Ionia. This is called the CIS, which stands for Clinton, Ionia, Shiawassee. How did this idea come about and when?
Well, I got involved in approximately 2007 when I was elected as a commissioner, but there had been a CIS advisory group a few years before that, and they were talking about, they began the discussion on what to do with this rail corridor, and so in approximately 2007, when I joined, that's about the time that the rail corridor was acquired from the rail line. And if you ask me what the rail line is, I don't really know right now. But it was acquired, and then conversation took place about what if we connected rail trails to make this project longer than 42 miles. And so discussion began. We had a huge number of partners in this. We had MDOT, Michigan Department of Transportation. We had the DNR, Department of Natural Resources. We had National Park Service. We've had local community governments, everything from townships, cities, counties, involved in this.
And these are basically abandoned rail lines that are converted to primarily walking and biking?
Yes, it's non-motorized. They're non-motorized trails, yes.
And there were some funding challenges, I know, involved with this idea, but eventually it was proposed that the Clinton-Ionia-Shiawassee Trail be connected with this other existing trail called the Heartland Trail. Where is that?
The Fred Meyer Heartland Trail goes from Alma to Greenville. It's approximately near 30 miles long.
And does connecting with an existing trail just invariably create some momentum here for expanding it?
Oh, it certainly does, because once you have a trail that is usable, safe, and beautiful, you have other communities that say, when can we have one like that? So it generates enthusiasm. When I first started in this project, it was a vision. And to go from Owosso all the way up to Greenville to connect, this is approximately 82 miles, to connect to the Heartland Trail. When those of us who are working hard on it have this vision, and you go out there and you try to tell others about the vision, sometimes they don't see it's real until it actually starts becoming developed.
Hmm.
And the financial challenges still exist. It's approximately $12.5 million project, and we're just grateful that we have partners like MDOT and their enhancement grants, the DNR and their Natural Resources Trust Fund grants, and the National Park Service, and most importantly, the Fred Meyer Foundation. What an organization that has contributed so much. They contributed a $3 million endowment fund to maintain the entire 125-mile trail in perpetuity.
Mm.
And without that, we would have had some extreme struggles because counties, cities, townships are saying, we don't have the money, you know, our budgets are tight. How are we going to take care of this trail once we get it built? So,
are you saying the CIS segment of this is basically paid for or will be paid for? You've lined up the funding for that then?
The funding has been lined up for
okay.
that, yes.
Yeah. This trail, when completed, would be the fifth largest rail trail in the country?
Yes, sir.
That sounds like a great selling point for tourism.
Well, Michigan has, I don't know if you know this or not, but Michigan has over 2,000 miles of rail trail currently. And it's Michigan is a destination. And when people look up, you know, they Google or whatever experiences for rail trails, and when this one is complete and they can see, they can come to Michigan and be on a trail that is 125 miles long and has all these opportunities of the communities and activities in between, it's going to be a destination. And I was just reading about a trail in Pennsylvania that's 165 miles long. It's a rail trail. And their documents say that it generates $19 million annually for the communities the trail runs through.
Hmm.
So one of the huge selling points is the economical advantages to the communities. And in these days when revenue is challenging, what better way to bring revenue to local communities and get back the activity in some of these towns and places that haven't had activity in a while. So
we're talking with Lynn Mason. Lynn's the chair of the Midwest Rail Trail Authority, which is overseeing the expansion of a rail trail network here just north of Lansing, specifically from Owosso to Ionia. Correct me if I'm wrong here. I'm led to believe that last November there was a ribbon cutting held for a section of trail stretching from Ionia to Saranac. What usages are we already seeing, or is it too early for you to have seen an impact of this?
Well, it is a bit early because the weather was just turning. As a matter of fact, there was a little bit of snow on the ground then, but I can tell you that I personally live about 20 miles from there, so I don't see as much of the day-to-day, but I have heard people talking about how many people they see on the trail, and it's generated everything from people who ride bicycles with fat tires to snowshoers to cross-country skiers. So based on what I'm hearing, it's already generated a safe place for people to get outdoors.
What's the funding future of this? You did point out the importance of you know, paying for this. In the future, where will this funding come from? Will it come from the kinds of partnership you alluded to earlier, or are there other untapped opportunities?
I think the answer is both, because certain parts of this trail have yet to secure all the funding necessary. So volunteers and people that work in these departments I already mentioned have to go out and secure matching funds in order to get these grants. And to give you some concept of as we were working through this, we wanted a plan of the dollars specifically. How are we going to get these dollars? And we broke it into a pie graph that's approximately like, I'll just rough it in, like 80% of the funding could come from state and federal grants, 15% approximately could come from private funding, and the rest, approximately 5%, could come from local community contributions. And the thing is, when we first started, we added the local community contributions because we said all these townships and municipalities and counties need to have ownership of this trail. So we've had to go out and sell the program, and now that section from Saranac to Ionia has been completed, those communities that border that section are really excited. And then there's other sections that say, when is ours going to be completed? And our projection is 2014, is going to have a substantial amount of this trail completed by mid-November. So,
pretty exciting.
It's very exciting. There's been a lot of work, and I need to give a shout-out to all of the partners and all of the people. We have what's called friends groups, in quotes.
Lynn, we're going to have to wrap her up there. I'm sorry. Okay. We're out of time, but we're excited to hear about the project. Lynn Mason is the chair of the Midwest Rail Trail Authority. Lynn, thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
Tomorrow morning on Current State, Congressman Mike Rogers responds to President Obama's State of the Union address tonight. Also, State Rep. Andy Shore joins Richard McClellan on a segment to discuss how to improve the qualifications of Michigan state legislators. Also, author Roman Kurzarnik, author of How Should We Live? That's all tomorrow here on Current State. You may have heard today that folk music legend Pete Seeger died at the age of 94 yesterday. Seeger was considered by many to be the greatest folk singer of his generation. His career spanned six decades. He was an outspoken liberal political activist who, as recently as 2011, protested in New York as part of the Occupy Wall Street movement. Current State leaves you now with one of Pete Seeger's many classics. Thanks for joining us. It's Current State on WKAR.
What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that Washington never told a lie. I learned that soldiers seldom die. I learned that everybody's free, and that's what the teacher said to me. That's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school. What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? I learned that policemen are my friends. I learned that justice never ends. I learned that murderers die for the crimes, even if we make a mistake sometime. And that's what I learned in school today. That's what I learned in school. What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine? What did you learn in school today, dear little boy of mine?